Today is August the 30th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and we are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and the program is live stream, and both are available on at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. The live stream is on WBAI.org. Podcasts of this program and other programs of the Personal Computer Show are available on PRN.FM and WBAI.org and our website, PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is in a membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled, but the regular program will always continue to be available each Wednesday on PRN.FM. And we have a live guest tonight, and her name is Dr. Rebecca Mercury, and we'll have her on in a few minutes after I cover some of the important news items that occurred in the past week. You know, 3D printing is real technology. It is disruptive technology, but there are three factors in there: cost, size, and strength of material. Well, cost has come down. Size, well, they started off small. You can now have a 3D print of quite large industrial size at much higher cost. They're related with each other, cost and size. But the big thing that's been holding it back is strength of material. It's all plastic. Well, a company by the name of Markforged has come up with two new printers that uses carbon fiber-infused nylon that is as strong as steel. It is 20 times stronger than plastic and 10 times stiffer. So hopefully with this, in due time, it will get into the consumer area itself. And that's one of the things that I think we've been hoping for. Another item is that the FTC has been investigating a company, and they found that the company was scamming the computer users, and they were operating under the name of Advanced Tech Support, and another name was Inbound Core Experts, and they were selling them. They were selling to consumers bogus security software, and there's a settlement of $10 million. The FTC originally sought $120 million, probably was somewhat inflated. Maybe the true amount was maybe closer to $60 million. And they settled for $10 million, and what they're saying is that if you've been one of those victims, contact the FTC. And that represents something like, in terms of real money, somewhere between, maybe 8 cents on the dollar or 16 cents on the dollar. And if you don't respond, the FTC does not keep the money. The pot just becomes available to whoever does respond. So the amount may get larger than that. So if you've been a victim of Advanced Tech Support or Inbound Core Experts, get in touch with the FTC on that. And finally, one other item I have is that I must say that I'm a T-Mobile user, but one of the big items that T-Mobile announced was they're going to be building out low-band wireless network in the rural areas, and they're going to be rolling out some new technology using 600 megahertz LTE. And I was kind of surprised by this because the FCC said they have 2 years to complete this rollout to all the rural areas. And T-Mobile says, 2 years? No, we're going to do it in 6 months. That's very ambitious. And what it is that they are using a new modem that was developed by Qualcomm. It's called the X20 LTE modem, and that will help them install some of the equipment in more advanced equipment. The only thing that I'm a little concerned about is that they are working with public television in terms of public access, and they'll be using some of the towers or taking over some of the towers, probably because some of the public access stations just can't make it because they are lacking funding. And the reason why they lack funding is because when they negotiated the contracts with the cable companies, it was done by the municipalities. That means the money is filtered through the municipalities, or what they call the city fathers or the town fathers, before they get the actual funding to continue an operation. Unfortunately, public access television, which is very important, is no longer available in 10 states, and the number of other states are in monetary poverty, I guess, it's growing, and I hope we can stop that. But let me get to our guest tonight. We have Dr. Rebecca Mercury. She's been referred to as one of the leading international experts on electronic voting, and she has a doctoral dissertation, Electronic Vote Tabulation, Checks and Balances, and she comes from, she did that at the Engineering School of UPenn. And hey, Rebecca, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Listen, I understand now you're teaching. What are you teaching?
Yes, I'm actually up here at Drew University in northern New Jersey, in Madison, New Jersey. I'm speaking to you from my office here, and I'm teaching computer science, and we're working on developing a cybersecurity minor.
Oh, gee, that's great. And we've had you on the air in the past, and I hope we get you on a more regular basis. The primaries are coming up in September, and I think, I'm going to ask you a big macro question. How accurate will the vote count be with the primaries?
Well, that's the interesting thing. We really don't know, because they don't do, there's nothing, New Jersey especially, where I'm at, it's almost all electronic voting, and there's no way to do a recount from the electronic, so you just have to accept what came out of the computers. And the only thing you can recount is the absentee ballots. And in my county where I live in Mercer County, New Jersey, the election supervisor, she's having a big push on to try to get more people voting as absentee, because that is the only way we can accurately count the votes. So, other counties may do the same. Many states went to electronic, and they found it to be foolhardy, and then they did go to paper. So New York, I believe uses paper, and that does provide the opportunity to do a recount. But then some states, including Florida, that went to paper, they actually created laws that make it illegal to count the paper. So it's nice to have the paper, but not if you can't count it. Michigan also, that came up in the presidential election. So people didn't realize that, we can't count those paper ballots.
Let me ask you a simple question. In New Jersey, I know in New York, in the city, we have these scanners. Of course, you fill out the paper ballot, and then in the scanner scans them in. But other counties in New York State, they don't necessarily use a scanner. So in New Jersey, is it all the counties are using the same machine, or different kinds of technologies are implemented?
Well, pretty much they had all gone with this one machine, the Sequoias, which are totally outmoded. You remember the days of the Z80 microprocessor. That's what they're using in there. I mean, it's not a Pentium. It's not a,
Wait a minute. Z80? You mean they
Z80, I am not kidding you. Yes, Z80.
You mean they have to go to the junkyards to get the CPU?
I think it's still manufactured, but it's manufactured overseas. So, any types of, code that could compromise it could be developed right into the microprocessor. But not only that, you're going to love this. So Princeton University and the computer science department there, they've been hacking into these voting machines for years. We actually, I say we because I also, a bunch of us bought them at auction when the other states were saying, we're not going to use these. So they were selling them at auction, for like $50, $60. I mean, a whole voting machine, you just have to pay for the shipment to get them, up here. So the Princeton University professors, they were hacking into all sorts of voting machines. And you would think, and they published papers on it and testified in court, including in New Jersey and everything. You would think that the state would be, they would be wise enough not to put voting machines. They actually have voting machines, the real voting machines that are used in elections. They have them sitting there in the actual computer science building, just sitting there prior to the elections. I mean, they could have picked. Why did they pick the physics building? But, it's like, hello, are you asking for trouble? So they're just sitting out there. I was astonished to see them there, just these voting machines just sitting out. At least in Pennsylvania, they also use the electronics. So, again, there's no way to do an independent count. But they at least have a sticker on them saying that it's a felony to tamper with them. But not in New Jersey. There's no stickers on them at all. They're just sitting out there right in the front lobby of the computer science building, already there for people to hack into.
Well, when you say electronic voting machines, it's not just one kind. It's different kinds, though, right?
There are different kinds. There's the touchscreen kind, which was really notoriously problematic, but many places are still using them. And but some of the places like Maryland that did buy them, and also Florida, they just found them so problematic that they got rid of them and went to the paper. But New Jersey, and I think maybe some of the places in New York, they have a kind. It's a whole panel of push buttons. You know, but still, it's just covered over by a piece of paper with the names of the candidates. You could shift that over, and then you'd be pushing for the wrong button. So there's a lot of ways that you can defeat, the accuracy of the vote before you even, get even to the tallying part. You can misalign it. There's all sorts of things you can do.
Well, let's not use the word fraud, but you're saying that there could be a great deal of election inaccuracies. No one really knows what it is. If, from a gut feel point of view, do you think it made a difference at all in the presidential election?
Well, again, we have no real way of knowing. But what we do know is that there were some states that, that people did want to try to do a recount, but they couldn't. There was no way to do it. And we just don't know. I mean, there really isn't a procedure in place when an election is close or there's some disputed facts about it. They don't do a comprehensive type of audit of the type that would be, considered scientifically or mathematically sound. But they, they have their own type of audit, but it's not really as scientific as it needs to be.
Well, let me ask you a question that probably it's in the news media and they don't know any better than anyone else, which is, what did the Russians do or didn't do?
Well, we know that, we have it on good authority from federal investigation bureaus and that sort of thing, that the Russians actually did attack pretty persistently attack the voter registration databases. And they've never really released exactly what happened, but that was when they were having hearings during the summer. I was watching these hearings on C-SPAN where, the different, the FBI actually said that they, and I think also Homeland Security, said that they would go into the various states and make sure that their voter registration databases and some of the other things that were online, that they would make sure that those were shored up and, protected from being tampered with, especially on the day of election when you need to be able to know who the voters are going to be if they're going to sign in. But there were some states, including the state of Georgia, and they just turned it down. They were like, well, we think we know what we're doing. But then it turned out months later that Georgia didn't really know what it was doing, and now there actually is a lawsuit that's going to be pending to try to get rid of the electronic voting machines there. They've actually...
Wait a minute. You're talking about registration and voting machines. They're two different things.
It is two different things, but they hacked into, and were persistently attempting to hack into. The claim is that they didn't make any changes, but we don't really know that for a fact necessarily. But what we know that was being attacked was the voter registration databases, but we don't know for a fact whether the vote programming cartridges were actually attacked or, the machines are not online in most places. But some of them actually have a way of sending back their data at the end of the day that could also have been tampered with, but we don't know. We really, there wasn't monitoring of all of this. We only know it after the fact that there was evidence that some things had happened.
Well, when you say that they might have affected the database, the registration database, you mean they might have done us a favor and removed some of the dead people?
I don't think that they might have been removing them. They might have been adding more dead people. we don't know exactly what they did. But, you know, it's just the same as we call in computer science and security a denial of service attack. So if you come in and you've registered and you've voted in the same precinct for 40 years and all of a sudden, you know, you come in and where's my name? It's not there. So now you have to go protest that. Or in New York, they actually have a process for that. If you're not in the database, then, you know, there's a special paper ballot that you can use, and then that'll get checked out, and that would be counted later, you know, when they're doing the tallying after the election is over. So it would go into a separate bin. But other states don't have that procedure. You know, New York's is actually pretty good. It always was pretty good, even when you had the lever machines.
Well, you know, I didn't hear much about people complaining that when they voted, their names were missing. I think that in the minds of people, when the media talks about the Russians trying to hack the election, most people think that they affected the count itself. And what you're saying is, not really.
Well, what I'm saying is we don't really know. See, the thing about the count is that it takes place in the central locations. So when you're voting at the precinct, and then there's all these voting machines, and they may have cartridges or they may be daisy-chained together, but basically at the end of the day, when the polls are closed, the count is revealed, and people will write that down, and, you know, they'll see what it is, and then the people who work at the polls, you know, that's their job to work at the polls for the day, they'll sign and certify that they saw those numbers. Of course, they don't know whether those numbers are correct, but then what happens, this is the critical step. The critical step is that then that data has to get moved to the county or the municipality, and then it's aggregated together. So the votes in your precinct get aggregated together to the votes in other precincts.
Now, wait a minute. Is that done manually or electronically?
Well, currently it is mostly being done electronically. There are still some states that are doing some of these things manually, like New Hampshire. And, you know, but these are, you know, relatively smaller states, but they do, you know, they've had long processes for doing this, and they feel that, you know, they have confidence in that. But for the most part, it's being aggregated together, and there's been a lot of, and this has been going on for, you know, since the early 2000s, there's been a lot of outcry by some researchers who believe that the software, which incidentally is from Microsoft, that it's easily tampered with. It's just spreadsheets. I mean, we can set up a spreadsheet to do anything, you know, shift, you know, 15% of the votes from this guy over to this gal. So these are all spreadsheets. And the question that has been going on all along is, how are these spreadsheets secured? Are they on computers that are accessible by the internet? So, and how are those checked? How do we really reconcile the individual voting machines and the individual precinct reports with the reports that come out of those tallies, or are they aggregated together and then it's just, you know, big numbers and they come out and there you go, you got an extra 3 million votes for Hillary Clinton somewhere. So, you know, well, but we don't really know how they're being aggregated.
What you're telling me is that if I were to move the clock back 16 years where we had in New York State, we had the mechanical machines, and in Florida, the hanging chads, we had greater accuracy than what we have today.
Well, you had at least a little bit more accountability, but right now it's all gone into this automation so much so and to such a great extent that it, you know, we've really lost control over the process. Now, here's an interesting thing. You might remember that there a long time ago, people would find extra money in bank accounts. And if you worked at a bank, if you were like the computer guru in a bank, it's like when you're calculating out the sales tax, there's all those fractions of a cent.
Mm-hmm.
So there were like these extra little parts of a cent, like, you know, 0.0005 of a cent, okay? Well, there were people who actually wrote software that would aggregate those little extras together and sort of send them off to an extra bank account that nobody really knew much about, and it starts to add up when you got millions of transactions and there's all those little fractions of cents. So this one woman, Bev Harris, you can look her up online, she's calling this thing called fraction magic, where when you're looking at a spreadsheet of voting tabulations, you look at them, it's displayed as integers. So it might say, you know, 145 votes for so-and-so. But in fact, it might be stored as a floating point number. So when yours is saying 149 votes, it shows that as an integer because you display and store in a different way. It actually might be 149.9999, and then you start adding up all those with the 9999s. Well, all of a sudden now your numbers are higher, and it's, you know, you got to do it, you know, a lot for it to happen, but you could theoretically shift the vote totals enough so that somebody would get all those extra aggregated votes, and it might be enough to, especially in local elections and even congressional races where you're really a lot of times just separated by, you know, tens or even hundreds of votes. So, you know, you do those roundups, and then you round the other ones down. So, you know, so you're doing these roundups and round downs, and now you're starting to see, you know, a couple hundred extra votes here, a couple hundred extra votes there, and that is of concern. You know, so this is one thing, this fraction magic. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on inside of these databases that we're not permitted to see. New York, though, when they purchased new voting machines after the Help America Vote Act, they did actually require that the internals, you know, be viewable, though, you know, when would you view them, but, you know, that sort of thing, and the manuals and all of the software is archived and preserved. Most of the other states in the entire United States, they do not require that. So it comes in, voting machine comes in, could get updated, maybe, maybe not. Maybe they're using Windows 7. Maybe they're using Windows XP, which isn't even supported anymore. So you don't know what they're actually using. And, you know, it a lot of places, it's really, really out-of-date software. And it was not mandated to have the most modern, up-to-date security on
Rebecca,
the voting machine.
Let me ask you, I mean, are we giving the Russians too much credit for hacking? What about black hat, white hat hackers? And they just do it for the fun of it, or they do it for real. I mean, we make it sound like only countries do it, but we have hackers from both sides of, from all countries, Ukraine and so on. And I think they do more harm than countries.
Well, sure. And, you know, what I'm saying is that all this hacking of voting machines, it's been proven. It's been out there for, you know, 15 years, you know. We're academics. We have to publish papers. So we've been publishing papers about it. A lot of the stuff was in my doctoral dissertation defended in 2000. So, you know, all these different ways that this hacking can go on has been published. It's well out there. And, you know, if hackers want to hack away, there's really been nobody to prevent it. Now, I served on the IEEE, that's the Institute of Electrical Electronics Engineers, Voting System Standards Committee, and we really tried, me and a number of other people who are IEEE members, we tried very hard for about 5 years during the mid-2000s to try to get a better security. We, you know, made statements, we made public statements, we testified before Congress, you know, we went to the National Institute of Standards and Technology. You'd think that all of these scientists would have listened to us. But no, they didn't. They didn't put in very good standards for the security of the voting machines.
Well, let me ask you, about 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, the New York Times published an article that was written by an advocate saying that open source code is much more secure than proprietary code. In fact, it's, you know, it's so secure that you can trust it. I'm sure you have some comments on that.
Well, I do, and I actually know the people who wrote that article and some of the people behind it, and they know my feelings about it. Too.
Well, tell me your feelings.
About it to a great extent, and I have quite a number of articles myself, and Peter Neumann, who's top security expert out at SRI in California, he and I have written a number of papers about how actually the open source is not, you know, just because you say it's open source, that does not mean that it's secure. You know, it means that, like as I was saying,
wait a minute. Wait a minute. This is published by the New York Times. I mean, if the New York Times is a standard when they say something, it must be true that it is very secure then, right?
Well, it was an op-ed. It wasn't an article.
Oh, you read the article. Okay.
They asked me to rebut the op-ed. It was an opinion piece.
You know, the funny part is...
Now, hang on, my website. I've got tons of articles about open source. And I believe in open source. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
But just because something is open source, that just makes it reviewable. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be secure. The most important thing you have to remember about elections is that they're very time-dependent. They're going to occur because the Constitution specifies the exact date for all, especially the federal. They specify all the federal elections have to occur on a particular date in November, and that's when they occur. So you can't, if let's say we found out this open source, completely bogus, completely be fraudulated and, you know, tampered with, and we find that out 3 weeks before the election, no time to fix it. Election has to run. What are we going to do? Give people scraps of paper to write the tapes on? I don't know.
Let me give you a scenario. Okay. Let's say I live in New Jersey, and I my regular home residence is in Bergen County, and I happen to have a little bungalow, down in Atlantic City. So I've got two different ones. What's to prevent me from voting twice for governor?
Well, nothing really. Because there during the Help America Vote Act, they were supposed to implement a cross-reference between, you know, people if they moved within the same state. So it was supposed to, the counties were supposed to flag that. But you might have had those two houses, you know, for 20 years, well before the Help America Vote Act. And plus, there's plenty of people with the same name, you know, so you have John Smith. And there's plenty of John Smiths. We don't require that you give a Social Security number. We don't require, you know, that you identify all the places that you've ever voted. And, in fact, we know for a fact that when you move from place to place, at least in the past before the Help America Vote Act, especially within the same – between the states, between different states, there's no correlation. There's nobody that says – you know, are you registered somewhere else? Did you remember to unregister yourself? Do they send you a form when you, when you move that says you need to unregister yourself? I don't even think there is such a form. So, you know, much less the two people with the two households, but people who have moved, and, you know, I would say probably a huge number of the listeners here have moved at some point in their life. Did they ever unregister themselves somewhere else? And are they still registered?
You're talking about unregistering yourself. I know that it's, in fact, it's very common where you go to school and you can vote, where you go to school. It could be a different state, and you come back home.
Correct.
It could be within the same state, and you're registered in two places because the name is never taken off. Now, I remember when I first was, I'm old enough to vote, okay? You had to be 21. Of course, they lowered that. And the other one was that to vote, you had to register each year. You had to come up with, you have to register to vote each year. Now it's lifetime registration where no one knows whether you're alive or dead.
They don't really know. And even when you're dead, it's like you have to go through a whole process to have some dead person taken off of the rolls. They're just sitting there on the rolls. You know, if their spouse comes in, they have to show all sorts of paperwork. You can't just come in. Like when I would work as a poll worker, people would come in and they would say, you know, my husband died, and so take him off. Well, you can't just say that by verbal. They have to bring in a death certificate. I mean, it's all complicated to get taken off. So, you know, it's not that easy to do. But the interesting thing is that the laws pertaining to who can vote, whether it's illegal for somebody who's not an American citizen to vote, you know, is all wishy-washy. So, like, for example, okay, so a person could theoretically, if they're registered in two places in New Jersey, vote for the governor in two places, but that might be illegal. So if you knowledgeably did that, then that would be illegal. But on the other hand, you have to check out the election laws to make sure that it would be illegal. And, you know, I think it's very loose. If you look at the U.S. Constitution, I believe there's 7 amendments of the U.S. Constitution, including that age thing you mentioned, that change the rules of voting. But not a single one of them really says you must be a U.S. citizen to vote. It doesn't really make that clear. It says you must be 18, but it doesn't really say say it must be, you know, born in the United States or, you know, naturalized or whatever. So, you know, now there may be other laws, usually at the state level, that would restrict that. But when people register to vote, they fill out the form. It doesn't ask, you know, how many other states are you registered in? It doesn't say anything like that. You know, at least it was harder for me to get, when I moved from Pennsylvania to New Jersey, it was harder for me to get a driver's license in New Jersey than it was to register to vote. I had to actually turn my old driver's license in. So, but the register to vote, just fill out this form, you know, check the boxes, you know, blah, blah, blah. So.
Well, you know, in the time remaining, let me ask you a quick question. The Russians were supposedly hacked into 39 states. How did they arrive at 39 states? There was, you know, why only 39 states? Why not all the states?
Well, it could have been all the states, but those were the ones where they had detected the activity that was actually going on. And again, they have, you know, they've been a little coy about, you know, how they detected it, what they detected, and, you know, whether there really were any changes that were made in the databases. But they were able to trace.
Well, let me ask you, these could be bad actors living in Russia, just like you have bad actors in America. We attribute it to a nation as opposed to maybe just bad individual actors?
Or it could be people somewhere else, not in Russia, who spoofed a Russian address. Now, you know, again,
yes,
hopefully I would think that the trunk lines would be able to be monitored by, you know, by the NSA. But we don't know. We don't know what actually they were using to determine or to detect this. But you know that when you use something like Tor, an anonymizer, you're going to get some other random IP address. So you could go through some anonymizers, which anonymize and make it look like you're coming from Russia, but you could be coming from Colorado.
Or especially people using public DNSs.
Exactly, exactly. But again, if it was going to be consistently coming, you know, looking like it's coming from Russia, it wouldn't just be a, you know, an anonymizer, because that you wouldn't know what you're going to get as far as the anonymous IP address is concerned. But certainly people could write their own anonymizer and make it look like they're coming through, you know, some other particular channel.
Well, so, for those who find this to be quite interesting, I know that you mentioned in the last couple of minutes you were talking about you have a website. What's the name of the website, and what's on the website that they can look at?
Sure it is. It's at www.notablesoftware, N-O-T-A-B-L-E, software, all one word, no period, .com. And then if you go to that homepage, there's an e-voting, electronic voting button down the left-hand side, and you can just click there. I've got articles I've written, some of the top articles, things to be aware of, you know, scary legislation that's pertaining to voting, why we want to be more secure and stuff like that. So there's tons of stuff, not just written by me, but by other people. And I am working on migrating some of that material over to my Drew website, but it's not up yet. So I won't give you that website yet. But
okay.
But over at Notable Software, that has been up since the day after the Friday after the Bush versus Gore election in 2000. That website has been up. So I'm constantly, you know, adding and changing stuff.
Let me ask you this, that, you know, we've been talking for the last half hour. It's been almost all doom and gloom. Is anything that is on the horizon that we could look forward to where at least some amount of the stuff can be filtered out that's bad?
Well, I hate to be even more doom and gloomy, but it's a group that actually has received money, some massive grants, to look at the future of voting. It's from the National Academies of the Science. It's called NASEM, of the Sciences, Engineering, and
Medicine. How do you pronounce that? NASEM?
NASEM, N-A-S-E-M, the mm-hmm. National Academy. This is a federal organization, but they operate on grant money. So this was funded by, I believe, the Carnegie Fellowship, and they're also Carnegie Foundation, and also Hewlett Foundation. And this is a group that has been formed to opine on the future of voting. But it's a very curious group that it's very heavily weighted on people who are involved with cryptography. And they believe, just like the people with the open source believe that open source is a solution, there are a number of people that believe that cryptography will be the solution. But if we have cryptography, it might be even harder to figure out whether the votes were counted correctly because everything's going to be encrypted. So, I mean, it's a very bizarre committee that has been formulated. They've had two meetings. You can find their website, NASEM. Just look for NASEM, N-A-S-E-M, Future of Voting, and you can read about it. You can see the slides that they're all talking about. But some of these people who, you know, have been, you know, supposedly certifying voting machines, you know, some of these people have been giving talks to this group as if it was factual and as if it was going to help things. But it's a very sketchy thing.
What you're telling me, there are fake experts out there.
Yeah, I would say so. And there's legitimate experts out there also who are opining on things that really are going to make it more obfuscated. In other words, they're going to hide the process even more rather than
Well, I'm going to be wrapping this up soon, but let me ask you a quick question. By having the election process in some states extend more than one day and go on, you know, into weeks, does that enhance security, or it actually, you know, it makes the security less?
It makes the security less because, again, it's like, so let's say we leave these voting machines in the computer science building at Princeton University, where the Princeton hackers are sitting, you know, a few doors down, and you leave them in there, you know, while you're having this advanced voting. We don't have advanced voting in New Jersey, but let's say you did. You know, now it's all, you know, all bets are off. So I think it's much less secure when you have this extended period. And again, it's much better, I think, you know, if you're going to vote absentee, which I have been doing for years, I actually drive down to the county seat and drop my ballot off there. It's not too far away, so I'm able to take it over there. Usually do it right on election day. So at least I know my vote got there. It didn't, you know, get lost in the mail.
Okay.
But, That's the way I would suggest people vote early.
Rebecca, I would love to be able to get you on at another time, and I hope you're available. And can you once again give us that website that you have? So I'm sure people may have questions, and I'm sure you're going to be able to entertain some of them.
Absolutely. So the website is Notable Software, N-O-T-A-B-L-E, software.com. And then just go right to that page. And right on the left-hand side, you'll see the buttons about, you know, electronic voting. And my email address is there and everything. So people can write to me, and, you know, I'd be happy to address their questions. It's been very nice talking to you.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to get you back on at a future date. We're going to move on. And, you know, I had spoken to Marty Winston saying, gee, we talking about backup power, but what about a building that already has motor generators? How do you tie in different powers to a motor generator, and what would the effect be? And he thought about it, and he did some study on it. And I'm sure you like to listen to what can and cannot happen. So we'll get to that right now. Hurricane Harvey has wreaked devastation in Houston, Texas. Our thoughts and prayers are for many of the victims. It was but a few years ago we had a storm called Sandy. It exposed a zoning code regulation requiring motor generators to be located in the basement and not to be installed above street ground level. In New York City, it is common for office and medical facility buildings to install a motor generator to provide a steady supply of electrical power. An example of this would be in an emergency room at a hospital where an operation is in progress. Hurricane Sandy brought in water that rose above the first floor or street level in downtown Manhattan. All the motor generators installed in the basements were destroyed. What is a motor generator? In simple terms, they are used to isolate electrical loads from the electrical power supply line. Large motor generators are widely used to convert industrial amounts of power, while smaller motor generators were used to convert battery power to higher DC voltages. Well, I asked Marty Winston, What's the effect of a motor generator with other power devices hooked up to it?
I think everybody here knows that the reason Hank likes my 40-year house, Cybernetic House Project, so much is that backup, backup, backup is only half of what we do. And it's one of those forms of backup I want to talk about today, but let's start with your car, and I don't mean to back the car up. I want to talk to you about the way a car runs and introduce you to some basics there that apply to backup, standby power generators, or online full-time power generators if you're really into it, and also how generator power interacts with UPS power. So let's start with the idea that you're behind the wheel on a perfectly straight, perfectly flat road, and my assignment to you is to make the car go exactly 29.6 miles per hour for the next 50 miles. 29.6 miles per hour, 50 miles. And a couple of you may think, okay, easy. Set the cruise control there and just sit back. And you might, but you might not. Because the cruise control in a car has a little bit of wiggle room. If you're setting it for 29.6 and it gets up to 31 or drops down to 28, 27, your car's logic probably says close enough, we'll adjust it over time. And, you know, for a car, that's absolutely reasonable. Also, any engine's rotational speed changes with its load. So in that car, if you get an uphill, your load increases. The engine has to speed up to maintain the ground speed that you've set as your target. And speeding up that engine doesn't immediately, if you're dealing in electronic terms, doesn't immediately impact the speed of the wheel against the pavement. It takes a while to catch up. Similarly, you start going downgrade, down a hill, and the car will speed up, and slowing the engine by itself, depending on the grade, it will take, again, a little while to catch up. And if it's a steep grade without using your brakes, that engine may not slow you down for quite a while. So the idea of the load determining the rotational speed of the engine is one that I want you to keep in mind. Now, also keep in mind, in that car, that engine has an alternator, and that alternator spins at the rate the engine sets. So let's say we equip your car with 10 sets of headlights, and as you're driving, you hit a master switch and all 10 sets of headlights turn on all at once. That's a big electrical load. Now, what does an electrical load have to do with the load on the engine? Well, if you remember junior high school, middle school, when you're drawing more current, the magnetic resistance changes. So it's harder for the alternator to turn at its target speed or the engine speed or any other speed. It's harder to turn it because of the magnetic resistance there, which increases the load on your engine. So the second you turn on those 10 pair of headlights, your car, even on a perfect cruise control, is going to slow down because of the additional load you've put on the engine. Okay, so, you know, we've got the idea of an engine running at a constant speed and some system trying to keep it at that speed and of what happens that can make that speed change. What if, instead of running the wheels on your car, instead of running the alternator in your car, that engine were running a generator or alternator as part of a standby power system at your house? Power fails, UPS is good for a few minutes, generator is good for hours to days, depending on how it's made and how you fuel it and so on and so on. So you might think, okay, it's going to be pretty close. How close is pretty close, and what does that matter to the rest of your house or to the UPS? There are factors that you could measure, if you had a mind to, in what a standby generator delivers to the equipment that's plugged in. And the things that vary most, voltage varies a little bit. That's not terribly controlled, fairly well controlled in the controller systems, which vary all over the place, that are built into these generators. It's more unusual for the controller system to lock down the frequency. 60 hertz could vary up and down. And the rate that it's varied has a name. It's called slew rate. Too rapid a slew rate, it gets its own impact. Let's talk about that impact. Here we've got a UPS, and the power goes down, and it's going to take a minute or two or three for the generator to start up, stabilize, and be ready to come online. So you've got a UPS that handles that gap. That's a very common, very typical role for a UPS, to handle the gap till the generator comes online. Generator comes online, and everything should be fine until utility power's back, and it transfers back to that, or until the generator needs a maintenance. You know, sometimes it's once every hour, two, three, 4 hours, that you have to shut it down for a minute and jiggle with something and get it restarted. Again, a UPS can handle that. But the more sensitive and smarter and economical and energy efficient the UPS is, the more likely it is to respond to things that it regards as trouble on the line, whether it's a generator power or utility power. If it starts seeing the frequency of power vary, if it starts seeing the line voltage vary, and if it sees especially a high slew rate, a fast rate of change of the frequency on the line, it's going to say, oh, that's a little bit naughty, a little bit dirty. We better feed something cleaner to the stuff that we're protecting. And so it will, at that point, engage its batteries to power its inverter to drive the load that's plugged into it and being protected. Okay, so what? You know, what if it's always there? Well, the so what is in the battery. Remember that every time you use a UPS battery, you're using up some of the runtime minutes that are kind of banked into it, depending on the immediate size of your load and depending also on the capacity of the battery at the heart of it. Also, depending a little bit on the type of UPS you're using. So the more you can avoid being on its battery, the better you are. If you have a continuous online UPS, a double conversion UPS, the kind where it's pretty much always charging the battery and the battery is pretty much always running the inverter, you would think it doesn't matter at all. And sometimes it doesn't, except that we've all become more energy efficient. And an energy efficient, big iron, you know, we're talking about at least 1,800 watts and up to tens of thousands of watts in some cases. The more energy efficient those bigger UPSs, those double conversion continuous online UPSs tend to be, the more they're running in modes that save the battery. They're using bypasses so that while the inverter is still online, while you still have a zero transfer time to go to the UPS power, the actual power driving the load is coming from the utility, or, well, it's stable, from the generator. If you have a generator, you know that it's run by an engine. You know that the engine can vary. You know that there may be a high or low slew rate, but the frequency can vary, the voltage can vary. So as you set up one of those more advanced UPS systems, the kind that might be in a server room, for example, as you set that up, it's a good idea to go into the amount it allows you to configure it and be just a little forgiving, a little loose with the settings. Allow a little variation from 50, 60 hertz. Allow it to have a slightly faster slew rate, a little bit more voltage regulation. And that keeps the generator powering the gear without the UPS kicking in, without the UPS batteries burning up some of the remaining charge. It still leaves you with full runtime if there's some reason that the generator has to go down for maintenance or anything else in the meantime. Well, I was working on the backup system, which is a cyber power backup, that's in my project house rack. And I came across something I hadn't seen before. So being the bashful guy I am, I called the company. And I said, what does generator mode mean? Now, this is, to my knowledge, the only manufacturer who has a generator mode in double conversion continuous online UPSs. It's in every model, I found out, of their Smart Apps Online Series UPSs, the ones with a model number that begins with the letters OL for online, do you think? I asked, and they said, well, it's just more forgiving. It's looser. It lets those things happen that I've already explained, and it doesn't respond to them. It decides, okay, that's not so bad. Everything will survive. We'll let that go, and only really switches back to the UPS providing the power with, again, 0 milliseconds. It only switches back if things go really crazy, and there is no alternative but to switch back. So when it does switch back, like when you turn the generator off or if the generator happens to fail for any reason, runs out of fuel, that can happen. If it does need to switch in, you have the full runtime of fully charged batteries. I also want to point out that when the batteries on a UPS are running, as soon as normal power comes back, recharging those batteries is an additional load for the utility or for the generator that's trying to catch up with everything else. You need to scale it for that. But I think the bottom line is, for those of you who are using the bigger UPSs, the continuous online UPSs, and you have a generator on site, either set the generator, set the UPS so they are forgiving of each other, or buy CyberPower and get that generator mode built in. And that means you've backed up your backup that you back up. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of regional computer clubs in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on astrophotography Tuesday, September the 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on passwords, how LastPass can help, Tuesday, September the 5th at 1:30 p.m., Community Room at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on the power of networking, Thursday, September the 7th at 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, located on 120 Bloomingdale Road, Room 101, White Plains, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting scheduled for September 8th at 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, located on the Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Rockland PC Users Group will have a meeting on Tuesday, September the 12th. Meeting time is 7:15 p.m., Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall in West Nyack. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Rules of Thumb for Computer Security, Thursday, September the 14th at 7 p.m. Meeting place is at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. Check at the front desk for room number, 31 Washington Place, Manhattan, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on AT&T Digital Life Home Automation, Friday, September the 15th at 8 p.m. They'll be meeting at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting scheduled for Tuesday, September the 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Meeting will be held at the Mercer County Library, located at Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting at 6:45 p.m. Thursday, September the 28th. 2017, at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Topic of presentation is Tips and Advice on Teaching People How to Use Modern Computing Devices. All these meetings are open to the public and there is no charge for attendance. We all hope to see you there at the meetings. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and also on WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe, keep cool, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.